be heard when they're in the basement, they're in the boiler rooms, and stuff like that. Go ahead.
K2K1.
No recognized. But to add to this one, Doug, on your original question, one of the questions frequently being asked is that I've got a data transmitter on the first floor of a building, a normal industrial building with engineering desks and drafting tables and a little bit of production machinery and whatever. And I've got a receiving site on the second floor of the building, a little bit dispersed in azimuth elevation off to one side. So I'm transmitting from, we'll say, one corner of the building to the other corner of the building, and I'm going through multiple floors. What will the signal look like? What will the signal strength be like? How fast can I send the data? How many dB of insertion loss will I get? Well, you do enough research on those kind of questions, and you'll find out that a number of smart people over the years have written very elaborate computer programs that try to predict what that signal will be like. The raw data the computer program wants is... Now, if you go to the right computer program, you'll find it wants to know the exact dimensions of the concrete floor. It wants to know what the wire lapping looks like inside the concrete floor. What are the materials that go into the walls? It may be sheetrock with 2x4s, what's the spacing and dimensions of the 2x4s. It wants to know all the objects in the building. Well, if it's a brand new building that is being built right now, that was designed yesterday, and you've got control of the materials, you stand a chance. You take a 50-year-old building that has been renovated 30 times, and some of the records are incomplete. Do you think you've got the raw data to go to that computer program to make those predictions? No way in hell. I immediately gave up on that, and I said, I can either try to create a computer program, I can try to make some guesses, and I can get some approximate answers, or I can go out and do the empirical measurement, and in less than a man week, I've got megabytes of data. I don't know how to process it all, but I've got the real answer, and I don't have to do post-computer optimization. I've got the real data in my hand of the real measurement of my environment when antenna A is in this location and antenna B is in that location. And so, to me, it was faster, more accurate, more pertinent, and real. And so we did it that way. And boy, it was an eye-opener. And so what I rapidly discovered, and I gave some speeches on this one within the building, within the company, is that we keep forgetting about the fact that radio propagates everywhere it possibly can. You stand in your office at your place of work and make believe you've got a large wastebasket filled up with ping pong balls. And you swing that ping pong ball basket as fast as you can, and you scatter those ping pong balls in every direction you can. Assume they are ideal ping pong balls that make every bounce correctly without absorbing any energy. And you can see, if I started off with a thousand ping pong balls and did that experiment, you can immediately see how busy that environment would be with bouncing ping pong balls within your office, bouncing out the door, and so on. Real radio does that. And somehow we have lost sight of that, and we have forgotten that. And so when it comes to all the crazy things that happen, when I hold my handy talkie in my bathroom in the morning, I can move it left and right, up and down, and I will see certain places. I will see certain places where the repeater I'm listening to on 0.85 megacycles fades out. But then if I twist the handy talkie in one of those places where it fades out, and the handy talkie used to be vertical, and now I twist it horizontal, all of a sudden that fade is gone. What's happening is that the environment is not only giving you a sum of all those millions of paths, all added in a voltage manner, and occasionally they give you a cancellation. All of those bounces and all of those cancellations are polarity sensitive. Some of those bounces occur at a grazing angle, at a 45 degree angle with reference to vertical, and therefore the signal coming out of the bounce is no longer vertically polarized. It's horizontally polarized. A long time ago, I discovered that if I put the handy talkie on the bench right in front, on the shelf in front of the mirror in my bathroom, and I put the handy talkie horizontal, at the horizontal handy talkie, I've got the maximum signal, and I get the best reception, and I can hear what's going on. And yet, that's opposite of common sense, because you and I know that it's a pure vertical transmission. Not in my house. For the last 15 years, without variation, I get the strongest single horizontal. K2KEY, I bet you've seen similar things, Mel. K2IW on the segnet.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, in fact, Dick had an email before about something about what you mentioned about Andy talking last week. But I guess the best example is the days when we used to have rabbit ears on television. That's how. That's why they used to break them off left and right, because they used to twist the heck out of them in crazy angles that they set them to try to get a picture without severe ghosting. So I guess that really is a visual for us, for many laymen.
That's
visual, really, what, like what you were mentioning, the signal bouncing all over the place. But I had a number of emails that want to know, last week you said with the Andy Talkie that they had set a record with supposedly two Andy Talkies, two guys, in, I believe it was in Colorado, on two hills, mountaintops of Colorado somewhere, 375 miles apart. And they used just brand new, I guess it was something, I think one of the manufacturers of the Handy Talkies promoted at the time. Now, you said you took your Handy Talkie and you spoke, I think you said 1,000 miles or more with it. And I got emails galore asking, you know, what Handy Talkie did you use? What frequency did you use? How much power? What antenna, etc., Dick, over?
WB to HWW.
How he recognized, it's going to take a little while to get, so to speak. He was moving in a 45-degree direction compass heading as he passed over Texas. He was over northern Texas, 1,500 miles from me. He was transmitting with a Motorola handy-talkie into a taped dipole-like antenna. It was a loop antenna that he had taped to the observation window on the cargo, on the crew quarters of the space shuttle. So he was transmitting 4 or 5 watts with a Motorola handy-talkie. For the first two passes, I was in the parking lot of AIL in Deer Park with an IC-280 in my hand, and I had no trouble hearing the signal coming from Owen Garriott. 1,500 miles between us, I had no trouble hearing him. Handy-talkie in my hand. I then went to the 5/8 mag mount that was in the car, and I went to the real car transmitter, which ran 30 watts. I first answered him on my handy-talkie, got no response. I then did multiple shouts with a 30-watt transmitter in the automobile, got no response. Finally, a day or two later, I did a careful calculation as to where he would be at what time. I transmitted 300 watts with a 14-element Yagi. It's the exact antenna you're listening to right now, aimed directly at him. I knew I had used a computer program to figure out where he would be, when he would be just breaking the horizon to me, because my antenna didn't have elevation control, and I aimed it with the right azimuth at him. So, assuming this antenna has got, I think, something like 12 dB of gain, the one you're listening to right now, assuming I was running 300, 350 watts of output, I had something like 5,000 watts of effective radiated power aimed at him. I bought the tape recording of everything he heard on the space shuttle during that mission. I heard my voice. I heard my voice that barely climbed above the rabble of about 1,000 other hands shouting to him at the exact same time. I just barely climbed above that noise with 5,000 watts of effective radiated power. The very first person that talked to him on that mission was a man named Lance. I can't think of Lance's call letters. He was located in Montana at the time, and he was running a moon bounce array. He was probably running 50,000 watts. The problem was not communication to Owen Garriott. The problem was the fact that he's 230 miles or 180 miles above the Earth. He's looking at more than a 2,000-mile diameter of humanity all at once. In that 2,000 miles of humanity, from his Catbird, cat perch, or whatever you want to call it, from his cat bird seat, he is seeing the darn many broadcast transmitters, radar transmitters, ham radio operators, whatever. What he needed was a huge filter on the front end of that Motorola handy-talkie. It was getting Ichabod from the kazoo. Mel, what would happen if you took a handy-talkie to the observation deck of the Empire State Building, where you're a small number of feet away from all of those broadcast transmitters, and you try to talk to your favorite repeater. The repeater will have no trouble hearing your handy-talkie. You will not hear that repeater, because the intermods, wall-to-wall intermods that your poor handy-talkie is going to get when it's in that rich environment, it's going to make the thing almost jump out of your hand. The front end is almost going to smoke, and you'd be lucky if your handy-talkie survives. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know what I'm talking about. Well, where Owen Garriott was during that transmission, a very similar situation occurred. So, 1,500 miles in that environment was easy. Now, what makes a 350-mile experiment on the Earth between two mountains a limiting range is Earth curvature. We all forget about Earth curvature. I live in Huntington. I am roughly 70 or so miles away from Montauk Point. I have stood on top of my tower, binoculars in hand, and I said, gee, if it's a clear enough day, I should be able to see Montauk Point if it's got a bright enough light out there. No way in hell. You do a calculation of what happens with 70 miles between you and Montauk Point, or maybe it's 80 miles. I forget the exact mileage. Between me and Montauk Point, the Earth bulges up in between roughly 980 feet. In other words, if there was a tower at Montauk Point, and I was going to have direct line of sight over that 70 miles, the tower would have to be 1,900 feet tall in order for me to clear the bulge of Earth curvature between me and it. I'm using smooth Earth calculation. We all forget about how fast the Earth curves. So, when you're 350 miles apart between you and your buddy, the amount of Earth curvature is fierce. My line of sight range on top of my little hill, on top of my mountain, my steel mountain that'll made of my radio tower, is something like 40 miles. I can see 40 miles. Lucky for me, because of some fancy ways the atmosphere behaves and the propagation occurs, I have on 432 talked to people 480 miles away. Well-equipped. Greensboro, North Carolina, 200 miles inland, is 480 miles airline distance from me. And I've made that as a single sideband QSO every Tuesday night for a half hour for a four-year period, starting in roughly 1980, talking to K4CIW. So, and we had about 90% copy summer, winter, spring, fall. And to study those signal strengths over that 480-mile path with no repeaters in between, was a real fun project. So, radio propagation is a lot different than the average person anticipates. I think Howie wanted to add a couple of comments to this. I think Mel wanted to add a couple of comments to this. We'll take you both in that order. Howie first. Go ahead. K2LIW and the TechNet.
K2LIW, B2HWW. Can you copy me okay?
Beautiful. Please proceed.
But Dick, I had to put together a repeater system for our maintenance group. And what we did in the area is we used a one-story building.
Right.
And we had to go out maybe about a half a block, three-quarters of a block. Instead of using height, we realized that we had to do it at ground level. That way we could hear all of the HTs. The repeater could hear all the HTs at close in. So height is not everything. When you do it, and we didn't use any fancy programs, but, you know, the HTs can get into the repeater even if they're in a boiler room. So you want to keep the reflections down, and you want to make sure you penetrate and get good penetration. So we used a low-gain antenna, and we kept it very low to the ground. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you use a high-gain antenna, you have to worry about the umbrella effect. High-gain antennas develop their gain omnidirectionally by creating a pancake pattern. You take the normal sphere of illumination from an omnidirectional antenna, you squeeze it down to a narrow pancake aimed at the horizon, the pancake parallel to the Earth, and what you end up with a high-gain superstation master-like antenna is an antenna pattern where you've got something like a 15-degree vertical beamwidth, or a 60-degree azimuth beamwidth, horizontal beamwidth, and when that antenna, the high-gain antenna, is mounted on a tall building, you get a beautiful signal out to the horizon. But if you're 1 mile away from the base of the building, you're under the antenna pattern. You're under the envelope. Unless they do something to modify that antenna pattern, you're almost in the know and you won't get a signal. And you get this peculiar situation where a guy 70 miles out is getting a beautiful signal and you 5 miles out can't get a beautiful signal. By inverse square law, you go through the math of his final comments. Look what he caused. K2KEY first. Go ahead, Mel. K2IW on the TechNet.
Okay, you know, especially about the, you mentioned about the curve, Earth's curving. There was a whole story about when they were designing the Verrazano Bridge, the company that did the design, and almost had a terrible error that one of the engineers at the company picked up, and it says that the length of the bridge, they didn't realize because of that long length of the Verrazano Bridge that they forgot to factor in the curvature of the Earth. So they almost had a major engineering goof there that was just lucky, picked up by a very alert person. What happens, Dick, one more thing, what happens if we took our handy talkies? They mentioned about being from mountaintop to mountaintop. What would be the effect if we took our handy talkies and went out on the, say, pure ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, on a very calm day? What will be the effect? Will the water affect it different than terrestrial, Dick, over?
Absolutely. And depending on what day you do that on, you'll get huge differences in results. Over water path, the best example I can give of this is that on the 432 band, which is only three times higher than 2 meters, and I'll admit I was using horizontal polarization, although it doesn't make a big difference. There are days in the year when you get a moist layer of air over the ocean down low. You get a drier, warmer layer of air up high. Because water has a dielectric constant of 81, it's kind of obvious that water vapor is going to be an air mixture with a much higher dielectric constant than normal air. It has a certain refractivity index. When the layer of moisture close to the surface and the layer of drier air up top has the right rate of change of moisture versus altitude, and if you get a particular weather condition where you get that right condition over a large number of square miles of that ocean between you and the guy you want to talk to, you can easily get a condition where the signal gets bent downward by that more dense air down low and the less dense air up high, dielectrically speaking, and you can get the condition where the signal follows Earth curvature almost exactly. It's called the super refraction condition. When you're within 200 miles of a major body of water, like the Atlantic Ocean, you get the super refraction condition on average some portion of every single 24-hour day. In other words, if you're a serious UHF microwave operator, you literally get a band opening every single day. It may occur at 2 o'clock in the morning, which is one of the favorite times. I mean, just the way the dew forms on your grass late at night in the summertime, that's exactly the condition we're talking about. Very moist air, saturated air down low, much drier air up high. Therefore, to the guys who do serious 10 gig operating, they always are unhappy about the fact that some of the contests used to end at 8 p.m. at night. And for those guys that are dirty stay-outs and late stay-ups that would be up at midnight, they would say, boy, the signal is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And so for the guys that really stay up late, you'd see quite often a peak of signal at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then many of these old UHF microwave contests, the 10 gig up contests, used to start at 8 o'clock in the morning. And the guys that are super enthusiastic are testing out their equipment 6 o'clock in the morning. I, for instance, was testing out my equipment with the antenna aimed to the northeast, and I picked up Dave O'Lee, K1WHS, in Lebanon, Maine. I don't know the exact distance. I guess he's about 350 miles away from me, 300 miles in that order. And his signal is booming in at 6:30 in the morning. I'm testing my equipment. I heard him off the back lobes of my antenna. I swing my antenna toward him, and he's 60 dB out of the noise. And I'm even louder to him at that particular instant. So we're noticing at 6:30, I said, gee, normally working main on 10 gigs is a pretty tough haul. We're going to have a good contest today, aren't we, Dave? And Dave says, yeah, we got it made. So we check with each other at 7 o'clock, 7:30. The signal is getting weaker and weaker. We check with each other at 7:50, and his signal is barely above the noise at 7:50. And the contest begins at 8 o'clock. We didn't make it at 8 o'clock. We made a couple of schedules after that, each hour on the hour, and I think I eventually talked to him some later time during the day. But that shows you what happens late at night. So when it comes to an overwater path between me and Florida, I know that if somebody was well-equipped down there on 10 gigs, certain times of the day, Florida would be easy. I've talked to Florida on 432 during a particular band opening once where the weather condition was just right, and that band opening lasted for 18 hours. I remember picking up the guy late at night, talking to him early in the morning, talking him to him at noontime the next day. So the way the weather conditions occur over water, nice smooth ocean, so to speak, you don't even need reflection off the ocean. Just air mass bending can give you a super long propagation. Now, you're about to ask, how come we haven't seen these effects on, say, the 10-meter band? The thickness of the atmosphere that has the right change of moisture versus altitude, the thickness required to do this super refraction propagation, that thickness gets smaller and smaller as you get to higher and higher frequencies. Those band openings that I just described as super refraction, you're going to get it occasionally on 10 meters. You're going to get it more frequently on 2 meters. More frequently than that on 432. It's going to happen some portion of every single day when you're on 10 gigs. Common sense would tell you a 10 gig signal is going to propagate like a flashlight, and you're never going to have anything beyond line of sight. You'd be amazed the number of contests that I've talked to the guys on Mount Equinox and Pacmananac in New Hampshire, Mount Mansfield, New Hampshire, I'm trying to think now, Mount Greylock, and so on. Quite often I've talked to those guys with tremendous signals on 10 gigs, and the 2-meter liaison signal frequency, where we're supposed to be lining up the contact, the signal just barely gets there.
Using that logic, I come to you, and I say, listen, Dick, I want a mountain tough, so I got my choice right at the seashore. I want to operate amateur radio from, say, 160, let's go to 10 gigs. Is there a place, has there ever been any survey, to your knowledge, where the best part of the United States is to operate, or the best part of the world to operate on the, I don't know.
I think we timed out the machine. But I was hearing you on the input, Mel. If I was a pure 160-meter operator, and I could get that beautiful ground plane of nearby seawater, I'm setting up my wires near a ocean front, and I've got a good vertical or horizontal antenna on 160, mostly vertical. I've really got the resources. Seashore on 160, I'm almost positive it's going to give you the best. Arnold W2HCW had a seashore environment in Setauket, and on 80 and 160 meters, he owned that band. He loaned it to us periodically, but he owned it. He was the first guy to open it up and the last guy to close it down when the propagation changed. If you're a VHF, UHF operator, you want to be on top of a mountain, because if this was a smooth earth, I'll admit it wouldn't matter very much. But because you've got other local mountains, buildings, water towers, forests, and everything else, getting that signal the first mile away from your antenna is the hard part. Obvious by the fact that I can hand my son my handy talkie and have him walk down the street, and by the time he gets a mile away from my house, handy talkie to handy talkie, because of all the obstructions in between, we're getting marginal communication. If I take that handy talkie and I climb my tower, as I've often done, with my handy talkie on top of the tower, I have no trouble hearing the repeaters in New Jersey, Torrington, Connecticut, mountain around for the nearest couple of miles, and he'd like to put a power tower on top of it to clear the trees. So obstacles are the major problem. We've already calculated last week and this week that handy-talkie to handy-talkie, transmit power versus to receive sensitivity, can overcome 150 decibels. That's the power spread that a cheap old IC2AT handy-talkie made by ICOM, 2 million of them are produced. I'll bet you 1.4 million of them are still in service. I own 4 or 5 of them. That silly little radio can overcome 150 dB between transmitter and receiver, rubber duck to rubber duck. Theoretically, it can get you 3,100 miles in space. I personally have gotten 1,500 miles in the listening mode for a bunch of reasons, Owen Garriott didn't hear me when I transmitted back to him, but that's because of his local noise. Very similar to what your wife says, I can't hear you when I'm in the shower. I mean, her voice and your voice are equal in amplitude. Her hearing and your hearing are equal in sensitivity. She's in the shower. She says something softly. You're on the outside, one room away. You have no trouble hearing her. You shout with the top of your lungs, and she can't hear you because she is inches away from a shower head that's spraying out water and making all kinds of local noise. The local QR Mary is dominating. That's what was happening to Owen Garriott. He was seeing all of those signals blasting at him from the earth. I had no trouble hearing him because down low, all the obstacle propagation insertion laws was eliminating all those terrestrial signals. I heard none of them except the ones that were 1 mile away from me, but up at some angle above the above the horizon. If I had a strong enough telescope, in theory, I could see the space shuttle aiming toward me, and I had direct line of sight to it. So, what I think Howie was also saying is that when it comes to very long range propagation, there is a difference between horizontal and vertically polarized propagation. All the experiments done to date tell you that very long range propagation, horizontal, has a slight advantage. And the reason for that, the blocking objects favor vertical. Those telephone poles, those trees, those buildings, they're primarily vertical objects. Therefore, they give you a little bit more attenuation to a vertically polarized signal than a horizontally polarized signal. And if you have only a little bit of knowledge of propagation, that's going to seem opposite of common sense, because when a signal reflects off the ground, the horizontal signal reverses in polarity. You get a phase reversal. Vertical doesn't do that at a grazing angle. Therefore, horizontal tends to give you a certain takeoff angle. Your horizontally polarized dipole antenna below the ground that is 180 degrees out of phase, because the reflection off the ground gives you this phase reversal phenomenon. By the way, it looks like the way the repeater is set up now, every minute and a half or so, you have to drop the carrier for a second, otherwise it times out. That's what I think is going on. So, with that characteristic, common sense would lead you to believe you have a pretty high takeoff angle, unless your antenna is a large number of wavelengths off the ground. That would lead you to believe that vertical should be better. Well, the long-range experiments have proven that horizontal polarization is the best on a very long range. I think that's approximately what you were getting to, Howie. Is that true? Back to you, Howie, on that one. Then I'm going to send it back to Mel and then to Doug in that order. Howie first. Go ahead.
So it's 2:40 linking. Be here in Atlantic City. And we were doing some video linking back in the early 80s. I also think he has less noise.
Yeah, Howie had another good point there. Most of the man-made noise is a little bit louder vertical polarized than horizontally polarized. So that's another advantage you get with horizontal polarization. Very long range, horizontal experiences a little bit less attenuation from the trees and other man-made objects. Man-made noise is a little bit stronger to vertical polarization. So when it comes to long haul, go to horizontal. Now I think you've got some further comments. Then I'm going to send it back to Doug for a final. And he's opened up a beautiful can of worms there. K2KUI first. K2IW. You got it, Mel.
That's good. Can I make one more comment on this subject?
Stand by. Mel, go right ahead.
Okay, the final comment I wanted to make. Then overall, you just made a statement. You said what you see the antennas a mile ahead. If you were standing, like you say, on top of the tower with a pair of binoculars, what the antennas is within the mile ahead will constitute whether you are going to have a fairly good signal pattern off that particular antenna system. Then if I said that to you, well, if I get down here to the ocean, which is only 350 feet to my south here, if you look there, you can see, I mean, you can see to the, whatever you like, you call it, the horizon. There is, of course, no obstruction whatsoever. So can I say then the best place to be then will be at the ocean thing, or if I am basically, like I said before, at the option of buying in QTH on top of the mountain. But can I honestly say that the should be the ideal location would be along the ocean over?
I wish it was that simple, Mel. With that oceanfront property that you just described, in that direction over the ocean, most of the time you're going to have some beautiful signals. But if you're a contest operator, and you're a VHF contest operator, and you're operating 2 meters in 432, you'll come to a very interesting conclusion. From the New York City area, where are the major contacts being made that rack up your contest score on VHF and UHF? There is a huge concentration of VHF, UHF operators in the area of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They're called the Pennsylvania Pack Rats, the Mount Airy VHF Society. They've got a huge concentration toward Pennsylvania. Your second big, huge concentration is in Boston, Massachusetts. The Boston Beltway high-tech area, around there you've got a lot of serious VHF, UHF operators. So with your oceanfront property, getting down to Philadelphia, you probably have line of sight over the water, and you're going to blast those guys. But the other half of the contest is up toward Boston, where you've got to go through all of Brooklyn and Queens at a crazy 30-degree azimuth angle, and then over the Long Island Sound, and then over Connecticut and Massachusetts to get there. In that particular case, you'd want all the altitude you can get. If you're a serious contest operator, and you look at the contest operations, you look at their scores, and whether it be guys with portables and a zillion operators and a lot of good equipment, or you look at the home operators, you look at the VHF scores over the last 10 years, and you will see a definite trend. The guys that live on high land with a good tower are the guys that are racking up the good scores. The guys that live in a valley, the guys that live on an oceanfront, they do pretty good in one direction. In the other direction, they don't do so well. So, if all of your friends are along the eastern seaboard, and the down south and southwest of you, that oceanfront property is going to be ideal. But you shut the door to all the people to the northeast. That's the other half. And which group is the more progressive group that you want to talk to? That's a tough one. I want to talk to both of them. It ain't simple. If you think the problem is simple, you only partially understand the problem. That's a quote of mine, Mel. Back to you for a comment on that one.
Okay, I guess you sort of answered. You need your QTH up on the mountain, or your VHF and UHF contesting, and locate the tower along the ocean front here, because I can tell you, like, for instance, on 20 meters, the South Americans here, which, of course, I can always joke with them. I said, a clear day we don't wave to each other, which, of course, you know, right here in the Atlantic Ocean. Straight south down to the islands of the South America here, they just always tell me, many have commented that you are stronger than many of the locals here. So I can say you need, in other words, you need two homes with the residents, depending on which contest you're going to run over.
Yeah, let me give you another data point on all this, Mel. You interview K2RIW, and you come to the conclusion that on a good day, he's got a 20 word per minute code speed. 20, 22, in that order. As a contest operator, he's mediocre. You look at a really proficient contest operator. On Morse code, he may be able to run off 5 or 6 QSOs per minute. You need to have a person alongside of him writing in the log as fast as he can, just keeping up with what that Don guy is doing. I ain't that guy. You look at my log book on VHF and UHF operations, I'm lucky if I get a contact every 3 minutes, not 5 or 6 contacts per minute. I'm running 15 or 20 or 30 times slower than a real good contest operator. I'm a mediocre contest operator. That's the bottom line of that. I'm not one of these guys that's real proficient at that. And when it comes to sideband QSOs, which are more than half of my QSOs during VHF and UHF contests, every so often I'm seeing the guy for the first time in 6 months, and I get into a 2-minute rag chew with him. Again, I'm not a great contest operator. But I did carefully choose what I thought was the Long Island equivalent of a mountaintop QTH that I could afford. There's higher land, but it happens to be 4-acre zoning, and I couldn't afford it. I settled for 1-acre zoning in a place where I could afford, and put up a medium-sized tower. With that fairly good location and a medium skill in operating, and because of my love of the 432 band, on 3 occasions, I won the New York City Long Island section using nothing but 432 on the June or September contest. One particular year, I won the whole W2 area, which includes New York and New Jersey, using nothing but 432. Never even got up to 6 meters, 2 meters, 220, 1296, and so on. Used nothing but 432 and ran up enough score in the June or September contest to win the contest. So from my point of view, if you're serious about UHF, VHF, altitude is everything. That first mile that you want to launch that signal, the handy talkie experiment is telling us, that first mile is good for, let me pick a number, 70 dB of loss because of the obstruction attenuation. Trees, buildings, water towers, forests, all that jazz. That signal, until it gets sifted through all that jazz and finally gets out into free air, that's where all the loss is. Altitude is the only way to get away from that if you care about all 360 degrees of the compass. If you only care about one particular direction, then yeah, a beachfront property would be great. And if you could find an island somewhere that's small enough and low enough that you're the highest thing on the island and you got water all around, yes, that would work like a charm. You ain't going to find that in the New York metro area. I think we're slowly concluding, Mel, that like you said, if you got enough money, buy two QTHs. Now let me pass it back to Doug, I've been promising. Look what you started here, Doug. But hopefully we've all learned a little bit about propagation. There's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. K2JJ, look what you started. K2RIW on the TechNet.
WBJHWW.
Right after Doug. Go ahead, Doug.
All right, Doug, I want to thank everybody for their input, too. Yeah, interesting stuff on the reflections of the CMAT here, Dick. I have a 10-element, 2-meter beam, which 10 elements vertical, 10 elements horizontal on the same boom, separate driven elements and 2 separate feed lines coming into the shack, which go into the coax switch, particularly on sideband, where most guys are horizontal. Weak signals, you don't know where they're coming in the best, and I have a lot of fun switching between the two positions, so it all makes some sense. Anyway, I'll let you carry on and get the next customer. Thanks a lot again for the great input there, Dick. Makes things a lot clearer. And like I say, you always listen and learn on the TechNet. So back to you. Take care.
With a testimonial like that, Doug, you're going to get the next 3-year subscription. You don't have to pay for the next year's subscription on this volunteer service. Do we normally have this, what do they call it on PBS? A pledge drive? Joking a little bit. Okay, Howie, you want to make some comments on all of the above? Go right ahead.
Yeah, Dick. You know, believe it or not, when I ran 220, when the 220 band, before they took away the bottom 2 megs, we used to be able to get between Queens and Atlantic City using, you know, 8-element beams, Fishcraft, 8-element 220 beams. We can do about 90% of the time get reliable, above-the-noise FM signals. So, and that was beyond the whole business down Atlantic City, over 100 miles. The second thing I want to make a comment is location on 10 meters, let's say 10 and 15 meters. Being on the water is probably the best location to be. There was a repeater down in the Virgin Islands that used to be on 2966 for many, many years. Every sunspot cycle, this repeater would be in day in and day out, 60 over 9. I would say that down in that area, the general area of the world, that was an ideal location to put a low band repeater or to have stations. The people down there would be able to come in and hear signals all over the world. So being down, you know, near the equator or being in that particular part of the world was ideal. Back to you, Dick.
I believe it. So, where's the ideal ham location? It's a function of what's your favorite weather, what's nearby. I mean, when it comes to pure miles of propagation, you probably like to be in the Caribbean. You got the right kind of weather conditions. The closer you get to the equator, the longer will be your miles of propagation. That's the good news. But now, what do you have in those miles? I mean, here when it comes to talking to Philadelphia and the Boston area, a couple hundred miles each, that's where the brain power is, and I like choosing certain guys there and picking their brain for an hour at a time, and we discuss all kinds of things. If I took those same 200-400 miles of range around the Turks and Caicos Islands, I don't have anywhere near as many high-tech people to talk to. So there's many variables. What else is new? Okay, I think the next person who signed in was Eugene. I believe you've got a question, Eugene. W2EWK, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, Zach, W2EWK, we turn it back to you. I bought I have an Icon 7000, and I bought a antenna tuner, AH-4. Now, my radio screws into it. Yeah, we're PL-259. Now, on the other side, you're supposed to put a straight wire to a 102-inch rip on your car, and you're supposed to ground, the box, the antenna to the car, give it a real nice, strong, ground, and have the antenna tuner close as to the antenna as possible. Now, can I take that one wire and put an SL-239 on it? Is that okay? Yes or no?
This is the W2VL repeater. The time is 9:15 p.m.
Okay. Some of what you said, Eugene, makes good common sense, but it might not necessarily be true. If you've got reasonably low loss in the transmission line, there is absolutely nothing wrong with putting the antenna tuner in the shack alongside of the rig. The antenna tuner does not have to be at the antenna. I will admit if you're using fairly lossy cable and you don't want to run high standing wave ratio in that cable, which happens to increase the loss even further, then yes, there is an advantage of putting the antenna tuner at the antenna. But in this day and age, for a guy with your resources and my resources, Eugene, you and I have the ability to get our hands, by hook or by crook, we can get our hands on fairly low-loss cable. In the case of an automobile, you ain't running that many feet of cable, so keeping the loss down is fairly easy. Therefore, you have the option, if you want, to put the antenna tuner wherever you like, in the shack, alongside of the rig, on the car seat, if you know what I mean. But now, to answer your question directly, the whip antenna itself, first of all, when a person sets up, and I think you said an ICOM 7000, I'm assuming you're going to mean the so-called communications receiver, IC-R7000, which tunes from 25 megs to 2000 megs inclusive with all modes of DMOD. That particular receiver, most guys like to put one of these disc cone antennas on it because it's the broadest band antenna you can easily buy, that disc cone antenna. And a disc cone antenna has a whip in the center and a whole bunch of radials coming off at about a 45 degree angle. I will admit that putting that kind of an antenna on an automobile is not easy. It's an unusual looking, not a very attractive looking setup. To try to get an antenna tuner on an antenna that covers enough of the frequencies that the R7000 can cover, that's a tough requirement for an antenna tuner. Not impossible, but very tough. But the good news is that you can tolerate a pretty high standing wave ratio if you're doing nothing but receiving. There's a whole lot of complicated reasons by that, but if your receiving antenna has a 15 to 1 standing wave ratio throughout most of the frequencies of interest, it'll give you beautiful performance. If you were transmitting into that antenna, it would be terrible. But as a pure receiving antenna, you can get away with murder. I know these are part of the answers you're looking for, but with an antenna tuner, with nothing but a whip coming out of the antenna tuner, right at the antenna location, and the antenna tuner properly grounded to the frame of the car, yes, that can be a good antenna. The whole frame of the car becomes the counterpoise, the normal radials that you put there probably are not required, and the antenna tuner can give you a beautiful match. But if you're doing nothing but receiving, you don't need a beautiful match. And I don't know of anybody that builds an antenna tuner that covers even one-third of the frequency range of an R7000. So you've got a pretty difficult requirement there. I may have misunderstood it a little bit. I'll turn it back to you, Gene. W2EWK, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dex, W2EWK, returns back to you. Okay, listen to me very carefully. Okay, I got the radio hooked up to the antenna tuner, correct? Now, on the other side of the antenna tuner is a wire, like 2 feet long, 2.5 feet long. It goes to the heart of the antenna. Now, I got a wire on the antenna that has a PL259. Attached to it, because I put a SL239 on the antenna tuner itself. Now, do you know what I'm talking about? SL239 to replace that long wire.
Okay. Listen to me very carefully. The SL239 connector, assuming it's on the antenna tuner, the PL259 connector, assuming it's on the antenna, the 2 feet of wire. Can you simply plug them together and make it work? Like a charm. And if the antenna tuner itself is grounded to the frame of the car, then over the frequency range where that antenna tuner operates, that should work like a charm. Back to you, Eugene.
I'm sorry, Zach, I did not copy. I hit a button on the radio, and I lost you. I just got you back just now. Please repeat it one more time. I just want to put an SL239 on the box, of the antenna tuner, just so I can screw my cable into my correct cable. Now, repeat again, please.
Let me clarify it.
Okay. The SL239 on the antenna tuner, and the antenna tuner perfectly grounded, that should work like a charm. A PL259 connector on the piece of wire, the 2 foot long piece of wire of the antenna, the whip, plugging into it, that should work like a charm. You can simply hook them together. If the antenna tuner is properly grounded to the frame of the car, then over the frequency range where the antenna tuner works correctly, that combination should work very well. I think it was Mel who said he wants to add something to that. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, yeah, he's talking about, no, it's not the R7000 receiver. He's talking about the ICOM 7000, which is an HF, VHF, UHF radio. It's a fairly new radio. Came out, I think, about within the last year, Dick, over.
Okay. That makes things a lot easier because it doesn't cover anywhere near as much spectrum as the ICR7000. So it's an IC7000. Very good. But yes, what you're asking should work like a charm. But as I was saying earlier, you don't have to have the antenna tuner at the antenna. Back to you, Eugene.
Okay, so now you're saying to me, it's okay to put SL239 at the antenna tuner and run the wire from the antenna into that, instead of one straight wire from the antenna to the tuner, correct?
Okay. Is there anybody who understands the question that Eugene just asked? I'm having trouble with it. I hear the words, but I'm not getting the picture.
I think I know what he wants.
Give it a go, because I hear the words, but I'm not getting a picture out of it. You got it, Mel.
Okay, they make a matching auto tuner for the IC7000 series. Is that what you want to hook up, Eric? Is that the IC7000 for the auto tuner, over?
That's correct. That's going to the A as an Apple, H as an Henry dash 4. Now, this one here has a short wire, a straight short wire. No coax cable, going to the RIP antenna, to 102-inch RIP. Now, instead of doing that way, one wire, I want to hook up coax cable to it. So I want to use an SL239. Do you follow me? I wish I had a piece of paper and pencil.
Yes, I follow you. Okay, you want to use the AH4. All right, now, if you put it in the mobile, you put the transceiver, the radio, in the mobile in the front of your car. You run a coaxial cable back, and you locate the AH4 in the trunk or in the back of the SUV or wherever it is. That's the coax cable from the rig to the AH4. The AH4, you can take a single wire, like you say. You can take a piece of coax and just use the center and connect that directly to the whip. I believe that's what you want to do with a short piece of wire. Am I correct, over?
Okay, that's correct. Instead of doing that way, I want to use the SL239 on the antenna tuner. Copy?
Roger, you can use the a PL250 or SL239. It don't make a difference. Right, and you're just going to run a short piece of wire anyhow. So the shield is inconsequential in this situation. Do you understand? Over.
Okay, this is true. Okay, I'm doing it. Okay, I'm taking out of the box tomorrow. I'm going to screw it down to the body of the car. It's not going to be laid down. It's going to be attached to the steel frame of the car. And right where the wire goes to, I'm going to put an SL239 onto that. And I'm going to screw my antenna onto that. Okay? And it should work. Roger, roger.
Roger, in other words, you're mounting the, using a chassis mount connector to connect the whip up. In other words, you want to connect the whip right to that connector, over.
Yes, in return, I'm going to put SL239 on it, opposite of a PL259, and I'm going to put that onto the ground as well. It's going to be grounded, and the heart of the SL239 is going right where that straight wire is onto the tuner. Copy?
Of course, yeah, that's what it's meant for. In other words, you're making actually a single wire. You're making a single wire antenna out of it. The AH4 is capable of loading a single wire, and that's basically what you're going to do. You're going to load a single wire, except you're going to mount, you're going to ground the 8H4 to the frame. Am I correct, over?
That is correct. Now, from now, it's going to have an extra ground from the antenna to the tuner, and the central wire is going to the antenna. So I should not get no RF inside the car. All the RF will be onto the antenna. Copy?
Yeah, it depends on, of course, what frequency. If you're going to try to do this with this 102-inch width and use it on 160 or 80 meters, you may have some problems without, you know, some kind of an inductive kind of coil. In other words, to put an inductor inside in that width system. But the AH4 will match a fairly long, a large range of different ohmic systems. So it should work, especially on most of the bands, but I would say to you that you may have only limited operation on, I don't know if you work on 160, but 80, yeah, possibly, but again, you may have to put an antenna on there with some kind of a coil situation, some kind of induction, and some kind of inductive system. But for the most part, if you're going to work like 20 meters, 10 meters, 15, it should work directly. Go ahead.
Okay, I realize that. I also realize it would not work on 160 meters or 86 meters, so it should work on 40, 10 to 40, and also on 60 meters. You're 100% correct. But the only thing I'm doing, I'm taking out the wrong wire and putting the SL239 on it. I'm just going to modify it tiny bit. And I'm going to use coax cable to go to the antenna. Amen?
Years ago, basically, I ran a similar system just with a straight whip, and I had a little tuning, I had like an L network, and basically, the AH4 is an electronic version of a tuner, and yes, it will work, especially, yes, 20 meters, 15, 20, 10, 12, 15, 17 meters, all that, no problem, it will cover it without any problems. I could say, it'll work, believe me. We'll discount, reactants and things, but that tuner should take care of it. Over.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And when I called the guy up over at the ICOM, he told me to use a straight wire. And I was trying to explain to him that I wanted to use an SO239 to have the ground from the antenna, and the straight wire is insulated to go to the tuner, and I've also gone to a straight whip antenna. And so anyway, I understand what I'm doing, and hopefully that you understand what I'm doing as well. Okay, to make something so simple, yes, it can be so hard, I'm talking about now.
Roger, yeah, I could say years ago that was a typical system. Before they had these fancy electronic tuners, you would actually put the whip on the car. They used just straight whips originally. And what you would add is a simple L network that you would adjust for that particular band that you were operating, and you were stuck with that. If you wanted to go to another band of operation, you had to readjust the, usually used a rotary inductor or a tap coil with a capacitor. So now they got it done electronically, and that's basically what you're doing. You locate the AH4 as close as you can to the antenna, so you're only running a few inches of wire, and a single wire that comes off the AH4 and goes right into the whip, and that's basically.